leading target of managing VT-resistant bollworms in cotton.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak today. You're going to be hearing many of the same things you heard from the previous two presentations with a little bit different twist, but my presentation today is going to focus more on management. I think the previous two presentations did a great job of summarizing that there is resistance in the Mid-South. And again, much like Dr. Kearns mentioned, in the southeastern U.S., in North Carolina, we do acknowledge the fact that the BT varieties provide a tremendous value for tobacco budworm. Despite that, we're still having increased problems with a bollworm as a result. Growers are having to increase their inputs, and we feel that they should change their management tactics as a result of this resistance that we're seeing. One of the things that we take into account when we think about management recommendations is the biology of the insect. And so bollworm moths will move into the crop. They'll oviposit. A lot of the literature says they oviposit in the terminal. We have some data I'm going to show you later that shows that they also oviposit within the canopy as well. But once those eggs hatch and they're primarily laid on leaves and squares, sometimes the bracts of bolls, those larvae will primarily move into squares. And so there's a pretty short period of time when you need the foliar insecticide to reach the larva before it moves into those squares. Sometimes if the squares are large enough, they'll actually penetrate the square and move inside of the square. At that time, they're protected from an insecticide. And then when they gain a little bit of size, their mouth parts are large enough, they can actually penetrate bowls. And again, they can move inside bowls and become protected from insecticide. So if you have BT that's working against the insect, we would expect it to take out some of those first or second instars while they're very small, and we won't need to use a foliar insecticide. But if the BT is not working, we need to make sure that the insecticide reaches that insect before they're protected inside that protected structure. Bollworms are very difficult to manage because they're polyphagous. They feed on a lot of different things, and that's reflected in their names. So they're called corn earworm and corn. It's not an official name, but a lot of our growers call them podworm and soybeans. And because of that, these insects have adapted to feed on a variety of different crops. And insects that feed on different crops have ways that they can detoxify things that those plants make. And so that makes these insects very predisposed to develop resistance to insecticides. They're very good at detoxifying plant compounds. And as a result, they're oftentimes good at detoxifying insecticides that we put out against this insect. So the polyphagous thing makes them difficult to manage from that regard. And in addition, because they feed on a variety of different hosts, it makes them very difficult to target when they're going to show up in cotton. A lot depends on what happens earlier on in the season. They can lay a lot of offspring. A single female can lay up to 2,500 eggs. They're relatively mobile, not only in the adult phase in that they can fly long distances. If you look at genetic information, it'll say that, you know, these populations are related in the Mid-South, in North Carolina and Texas. But on a local level, you know, that there's a little bit of genetic variation. But the larvae are mobile too, so they can move from plant to plant and off the plant under the soil. So it makes them difficult to manage. They have what's called facultative diapause in their pupil form. Right before they're going to change into a moth, they burrow down into the soil. And that's important because during that phase, they're protected, and they can emerge into a moth depending on environmental conditions. So if environmental conditions are not favorable, they don't have to emerge. One great example is if moisture is not adequate. They can sense that being in the soil will dry up. When they get a rain, they'll emerge. Also, when you get a rain, plants will start to grow better. It's a good time to lay eggs. There was a study done in the 20s or 30s in Virginia. They looked at a overwintering bollworm pupa, and they found one from the previous winter that didn't emerge until late August. So that pupa had stayed in the ground nearly a year before it emerged. It makes a pest very difficult to manage if it has that sort of plasticity built into its genetics. Many different generations a year, and we've already mentioned insecticide resistance. Pyrethroid resistance has been a little bit slower to develop in the Southeast than it has in the Mid-South, but we do believe that we're seeing a fair bit of this occurring. These are data from bioassay tests. All we do is we take male moths, we put them in a vial treated with a known dose of pyrethroid, and we see how many of those lived or died. While it's not directly correlated with resistance, we think that as survival increases, we're seeing more and more problems with pyrethroids in the field. And that's difficult for us with BT cotton because pyrethroids have traditionally been very effective for bollworm and BT cotton. And the reason for that is even if a bollworm becomes pyrethroid resistant, as it feeds on BT cotton, development is inhibited. So if it's able to survive on BT cotton, the development's inhibited. And because of that, it becomes more susceptible to the pyrethroid. Well, if you have an insect that's becoming resistant to the BT, it's probably surviving better. Its development is less inhibited, and the pyrethroid is less effective. So we have these two things clashing now at the same time where we have pyrethroid resistance and BT resistance. So we're having to make a major change in terms of insecticide recommendations to the system. I won't belabor this point very much because it's been done very nicely in the previous presentation. But these are data from North Carolina, and I do want to credit my my predecessor, Dr. Jack Batchelor. These are mostly data that he generated. These are from thousands and thousands of fields, and I want you to direct your attention to the graph on the left. And we have it split into fields that are Bollguard. Those are in the squares, wide strike. Those are in the triangles, and Bollguard 2, those are in the circles. And what Dr. Batchelor did was he went out and he did sort of, somebody termed it as post-mortem, I like that. He did a post-mortem evaluation of these different cotton fields. So he went out into thousands of cotton fields and he simply looked at bolls and saw, were they damaged by a bollworm or were they not? And so these data that you're seeing are just fields that had bollworm damage or fields that did not. So if they had bollworm damage, it's higher. If they did not, it's just kind of a presence-absence thing. And these are data over time. And you'll notice that the fields, the Bollguard fields, the incidence of damage decreased over time. 2010, we no longer had data on Bollguard. We did have data on Wide Strike and Bollguard 2. And you notice that they sort of fluctuate. But we really saw a spike in terms of incidence and damage in Wide Strike fields in 2012. We had a hiatus from 13, 14, 15. 2016, you notice that the incidence of damaged fields of Bollguard 2 and Wide Strike was very high. And in fact, we had a lot of fields that we had to spray for bollworm in those years. I initially thought that part of this was related to incidence of bollworm. You know, maybe we just had a lot of bollworm that were out there. But we've looked at average bollworms per day using light traps. And it's kind of a good way, sort of roughly over the state, to say, you know, did we have years that were high bollworm pressure or not? And I think this matches what I see in the field. And in fact, our highest pressure bollworm years, as you can see from the light trap data on the right, were 1996 and 2010. And those sort of match when we see those peaks in terms of damage incidents. But notice that 2016 was not a particularly high pressure year, but it was a year when we saw a lot of damage in the field. And so we think that this is a result of resistance that was out there. The other thing I should mention is that, you know, damage bolls are end of the season evaluations, but they're very highly correlated with in-season damage, looking at both damage bolls and larval incidence. So if you see lots of damage bolls, it meant that you had a lot of damage during the season. We have data similar to the Mid-South, not quite as much. These were generated from some of my colleagues in different states, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, Virginia, and of course our state, North Carolina. The only protein that we tested was Pry1AC, so this is important. We haven't looked at Pry2s, we haven't looked at VIP, but we have found high levels of survival of these larvae on diet-based bioassays, and they were the same exact bioassays that you saw in the previous two presentations. And so we think that based on these two pieces of evidence, that we have lots of survival in larval bioassays and lots of incidents and field problems, we think that we also are seeing the field-evolved or practical resistance that they're seeing in the Mid-South. So that essentially renders these particular varieties less effective. And again, as was very well stated in the previous presentation, we're going to have to, in the future, rely more and more on these varieties that contain the VIP protein. And so that, for us, sort of creates the question of, if we're going to have these varieties in the future, how do we manage them? But more importantly, for the near term, since we have an overlap when we have these varieties that are a little bit less effective, the Bollguard 2, the Wide Strike, and the Twin Link, how do we manage these varieties, and should we manage them any differently, knowing that we have some resistance there? These were some data generated from a student in my program, and what she did was she had different pairs of BT and non-BT corn planted throughout the state of North Carolina in 2016. And so these are, each one of these is a different location. And one of the things that she did was she looked at the amount of feeding in the BT corn hybrid, that VT double pro, relative to the non-BT. And so what I've done is I've taken that and I've created a proportion up there. And so where you see the bars that are low, that's where we had relatively the same amount of feeding or relatively low feeding in BT compared to non-BT. And where you see the bars that are high, that's where we had lots of feeding in the BT relative to the non-BT. If the feeding was equal, we had the same amount of feeding in the BT and the non-BT, it would equal a 1 on the graph. You notice that some of those locations, it seemed like they weren't feeding at all in the BT, but in a few of those locations out farther to the right of the graph, we actually had more feeding in the BT hybrids relative to the non-BT hybrids. So based on this bit of data, we thought this is interesting. You know, we can look across the state and we can see a range of behavior of these insects on BT. We also did some bioassays, and my little line's not showing up very well here, but everything else is. What we also did was we took these insects from non-BT corn and we put them on a 95% lethal dose of Cry-1AC. And so the reason we did that is we figured these insects are coming out of corn and moving into cotton. This bioassay will give us maybe a good idea of what kind of survival is out there. So if it's 95% lethal, we would expect only 0.05% of those to survive. And in only two locations, those on the far left, one location in Granville County and one location in Washington County, in only those two locations did we kill 95% of the individuals on that diagnostic dose. In some locations, there was very, very high survival, as you see on the right side of the graph. And it's very, very variable depending on the geography. So here's bioassay results from a single county, Washington County. This is the county where I'm located in, where my station's at. And you notice that we had populations that we would characterize based on this bioassay as susceptible. That's on the left of the graph. And two, that we qualify as resistant. And so for me, that makes recommendations very difficult to make. I cannot paint a situation with a broad brush. I don't know if these populations in any given place are resistant or if they're susceptible. You know, I think from a management perspective, we sort of have to take the safe route though, right? I mean, we're going to have to consider these things as resistant and treat them as such. These are a summation of light trap data from 1993 to 2016. And these are averages of bollworms that we caught in these light traps. And they show our different generations that we have there. And you can see that we typically have third generation that moves into cotton in late August, early September. The point I want to make is that I don't have that slide on here. No year is the same. So we had a big peak this year where that corn generation is. We had a lull where the cotton generation is this year. We had a big peak late. So every year is different. It says to sum up, so I'm going to sum up. Oh, here it is. So the thing we've been doing in the past is we've been recommending a larval threshold. And our larval threshold basically says, go out to the field, sample 100 plant parts, squares, flowers, bowls, and if you find three live larvae, second instar or larger on those plant parts, we recommend a treatment. The advantage of that is it allows some time for the BT to work. So if those bollworms are susceptible, they should die by the second instar. And it also allows the time for that BT cotton to wipe out any tobacco budworm. But the disadvantage for that is that foliar insecticide control is extremely difficult. Remember what I told you in the beginning of the presentation, the move inside of those squares and those bowls, they're just very difficult to reach with foliar insecticides. So one of the things that we've done is we've riffed off a discovery that they made in the Mid-South, and that discovery was, as you saw before, treatments with chlorantraniliprole seem to be very effective for bollworm. But this is a diamide class insecticide. It's taken up into the plant and moves to newly growing tissue. And so what that does is it provides an extended period of protection from bollworm. We tried it in 2013. I tried this on a very large field. It was replicated. It was with a grower. I didn't see a bit of difference in terms of yield. So I went back to the folks in the Mid-South and said, what did I do wrong? They said, well, you put it on too late. You put it on based on your larval threshold. You need to put it on earlier before those bollworms arrive or before those bollworms had hatched. So we were able to do that in 2014, and you can see that we significantly protected the cotton. We made 90 pounds of yield. The treatment paid for itself. Because of that, we have established an egg threshold in 2015 and 2016, and we knew that it had many, many advantages. It could protect the crop. Timeliness was less critical because you could put it on earlier. You don't want to be late, but you could put it on earlier. But the disadvantage was is that it didn't allow time in the system to kill tobacco budworm, and it's very difficult to scout eggs. I'm going to skip through these slides because you're going to see them in the next presentation and just kind of sum up. this slide basically bolsters what Dr. Kern said. We're going to recommend growers to pick the highest yielding varieties and to manage that variety accordingly. So I have two locations on here with the same varieties. In one of these locations, we had lots of bollworm. We had end-of-season damage bolls in this Bolgar 2 variety of 60% damage bolls, around 50% of twin link, around 5% in wide strike 3. And notice where those yields stack up below there. You notice our highest yielding variety in that particular trial was wide strike 3. And that's because we had very little bollworm pressure there. We'll look at another location where we had very little boll damage in the Bolgar 2 and the twin link. And you notice that our highest yielding variety in this location was Bolgar 2. And so based on this information, we really think that the growers need to put this in their budget. If they're growing the twin links, the wide strike or the Bolgar 2, they need to put in their budget that they're going to need to use a spray over top of this crop. We don't want them just moving to the wide strike 3 and the Bolgar 3 just as a result of bollworm. So in conclusion, should we use new traits or new management? We think they should use both. We're going to be recommending the egg threshold on those wide strike, Bolgar 2 and twin link varieties, and we're going to be recommending the larval threshold for the wide strike 3s, the twin link plus, and the Bolgar 3.
I think I went over time.
All right. So the question was, are we seeing any earworm incidences in VIP corn? I would say we've seen nothing that we would count as worrying, economic, really not a whole lot on pollinated kernels. I've been doing an experiment with a colleague of mine, Dr. Rie Jones at Clemson University. We take corn ears and we look at pupa and see if moths emerge from those pupa over time. Several years ago, we could never collect a pupa out of VIP corn. A couple years ago, we were able to collect one or two pupa. Last year, we were actually able to collect moths that it closed out of those pupa cases. So we think that the simplest explanation for this is that these things are developing tolerance to the VIP trait in corn.